So let me just like remind you of the things that happened so far. The first lecture we talked about subject matter and subject matter as sort of a way of like dividing up worlds according to the variations in how the sentence in question would be true or false. We then used that to model two different ways of like scaling a hypothesis back to a weaker hypothesis. The first was you go from A to the part of A about a certain subject matter. And there was like a simple explanation of where that came from. The part of A about a certain subject matter is actually it won't matter, so I won't say. Then the second thing we did is we considered a way of scaling A back, which involved taking an implication of A and kind of bracketing it or silencing it, coming up with something that no longer implies that B. And I said, although I didn't, you know, argue, that you could explain that kind of in a dual way. You can explain that as the part of A that is not at all about whether B. You can define like the part of a thing that's not at all about a subject matter as well. So these are the main players. Subject matter, parts, partial truth, truth of a part, and then these two ways of getting parts, restricting to the part about a certain subject matter and also restricting to the part not about a certain subject matter. Okay. Knowledge. Okay, so here's a bunch of examples that you're probably sick to death of. I'm not promising they're all to be understood in exactly the same way, but they have a kind of similar look. So we could explain them all like this. You know, if something is like clear and uncontroversial and nobody doubts it, and it implies something, clearly implies it, nobody doubts it implies it, then you would certainly think that the thing implied would be clear and uncontroversial. You know, controversy should not spring up between the premise and the conclusion of a valid argument. I'll just say premise, I won't be talking about multi-premise arguments at all. That seems obvious, but there's lots of examples where it seems like controversy does spring up en route from premise to conclusion, and so here's a few. So, Frege, the number of Martian moons is prime, therefore numbers exist. Moore, I have a hand. It's clear. There's an external world. Well, I mean, it's clear too, but it's kind of freighted with a kind of significance that we don't tend to associate with having a hand. Nozick, you know, I am standing, therefore I'm not a bodiless brain in a vat. Dretzky, that's a zebra, so it's not a cleverly disguised mule. Kripke's dogmatism paradox, I locked the door, therefore evidence that I didn't is misleading. This is kind of in the vicinity of some of Josh Cohen's examples. Stuart Cohen. It's 5 after 5. Therefore, my watch is accurate even if and only if it reads 5 after 5. So that's kind of bizarre, right? I look at my watch and say, oh, it's 5 after 5. And then I conclude from that the watch I just looked at is accurate only if it reads 5 after 5. I say, oh. Look at it. It's sort of like Wittgenstein's thing of like buying two copies of the morning paper to like confirm that both ones are correct. It seems weird that I can get confirmation of the correctness of my watch by, you know, looking at it, judging the time, realizing what time it had better be if the watch is going to be accurate, and then noting with satisfaction that that is precisely the time that my shows. But that seems to be what you could do with closure. And then finally, a whole bunch of examples, Harmon Vogel type examples. I get that from you. I assume they're called Harmon Vogel type examples. I don't really know the definition of them. So here's an example. I'll be teaching logic next year, so I won't die in the meantime, because that would certainly prevent me from teaching logic next year. So the implication in each of these cases sort of seems harder to know than the premise that it follows from. Now, this doesn't have to be interpreted as you do know the premise and you don't know the conclusion. But just to sort of keep things sort of simple, let's just assume that we're going to mark the harder to know in that fairly crude binary way. You do know the premise, you don't know the conclusion. Admittedly, when you look at some of these, in any ordinary frame of mind, you might well doubt the claim that you don't know the conclusion. I mean, absent every, you know, if you hadn't encountered the example and somebody said, I'm trying to figure out whether there's like, painted mules anywhere. I was thinking about, in zoos? I said, no, you can be sure there are not any, I don't think there's any, but there's none in zoos. Okay, so it's a very sort of contextual thing, and in some ways that's what I'm going to be talking about. So if we take the premise A to be known and the conclusion that follows from it not to be known, then we've got seeming counterexamples to the closure principle, which I'll state very crudely. Knowing a thing puts you in a position to know its known entailments. People sometimes say, knowing a thing and then deducing the entailment while retaining knowledge of the premise, and sometimes you want to add even more than that. While the knowledge should kind of hold fixed in various ways, the basing relations shouldn't change. I'm not going to pursue any of that. So the view nowadays is that these apparent violations of closure are just that. They've got to be reckoned only apparent, because the closure principle just has too much going for it, and the costs of denial are too high. It'd be easy to come up with a huge list of quotes. There's, from people who say, I can't believe that there is a brief, great, insane period in the history of epistemology when people question closure. Although, having, grown up in that period, it didn't seem insane at the time. Okay, so what are some of the costs of denying closure? Well, I'll mention just three. One, these are mostly sort of just, copied down from people around here. I don't entirely understand them. So the first one is, look, deduction is a paradigm of, a way of extending your knowledge. If deduction is not a reliable way of extending your knowledge, then we're really in trouble. I saw, when I was in graduate school, Kripke give some Nozick-bashing lectures in the mid-80s that just were published in his Philosophical Troubles. And he had a number of ways of making fun of Nozick, but one of them was like, if you'd be giving some argument, and then he sort of clap his hand to his forehead and said, oh no, I just committed the fallacy of logical deduction, right? Because he deduced something, but of course that's no guarantee that you know it, right? And he thought that was like transparently silly. Okay, second cost is, look, closure sometimes works, so if you're going to want to contain it, but not blow it out of the water, but all the known technologies for containing closure wind up either strangling it in the cradle so nothing survives, or letting it grow into a monster, at least in some respects. So take the standard kind of anti-closure theory, Nozick's sensitivity theory. You know that P, if I'll just put this very crudely, you would have noticed had it not been that P. Kripke points out that the idea is you can retain your lightweight knowledge, like your knowledge you have a hand, but you don't retain the heavyweight knowledge, like there's an external world. And Kripke points out, well, if that's what you wanted, you've actually knocked out a lot more than that, because we can come up with examples where there's two fairly kind of commonsensical kinds of knowledge, and they're much more closely related than the two that I just mentioned in closure fails. So I might know that it's a red barn, but not know that it's a barn. Why? Because if it hadn't been a red barn, it wouldn't have been red. I can't remember the assumptions that you need to make that work out, but you can easily do that. If it hadn't been a red barn, it wouldn't have been red. If it hadn't been, and you would have noticed, you got good color vision. If it hadn't been a barn, it would have been, an obvious fake barn, or it would have been a bowling alley, or who knows what. You can certainly imagine. Generally, if you've got P and Q, and it's easier for P to fail than for Q to fail, then sensitivity to P and Q is just sensitivity to P. You don't have to worry. You don't have to have any awareness of when Q is or is not true to be sensitive to whether P and Q. If P always gets to be false first as you sort of travel away from the actual world. And then there's also, John Hawthorne points out, egregious non-violations, at least from the point of view of someone like Dretske. Dretske wants heavyweight stuff to be not known and lightweight stuff to be known. But Hawthorne points out that even though on a sensitivity type theory, I might not know that I may not know that I'm not a brain in a vat, but just conjoin that with something that's kind of much easier to tell, like I'm hungry. I do know that I'm hungry and not a brain in a vat, because if I hadn't been hungry and not a brain in a vat, I would have been not hungry, and then I'm really good at telling whether I'm not hungry. So there's failures on both sides. And the third principle, and this is again from Hawthorne, that you can talk a big game, say I'm not going to worry about closure, but you actually would have to give up much simpler and harder to deny principles, because if you accept them, then they allow closure to come back. And so let's just assume this equivalence principle. If you know something and something else is a priori equivalent to it, then you know the other thing. Maybe we just say you're aware that it's a priori equivalent. Assume that as a background. Then here's two different principles, either of which is individually sufficient for getting closure back. One is the addition principle. If you know that P and you competently infer P or Q at a disjunct, then you know that P or Q. And maybe you should add some more stuff to competently infer. And then there's distribution. If you know that P and Q, then you know that P and you know that Q. And there's a proof in the margin of how you get full closure back from distribution in that equivalence principle. Okay, so here's a bunch of data that we're trying to sort of like make sense of. On the one hand, there's, you know, these fairly intuitive count. I mean, it's hard to counter instances or seeming counter instances. It's hard to like look at those, you know, the Dresky and the Kripke and the Cohen without feeling that. I mean, you may feel very confident of your ability to explain recalcitrant data, but it does. It is a recalcitrant datum here. I mean, it doesn't really seem there's something funny going on in these cases. You should have some kind of story about what is going on in these cases. And of course, people do have stories. You know, maybe you're confusing, you know, whether you know that B with whether you know that you know, or maybe you lose your nerve when you reach the conclusion B and you stop believing things, or there's various other possibilities. But here's what a solution should do to make what Schiffer calls a happy face solution. So everybody goes home happy, feeling that their side of the debate has been like honored. Well, it should pay some kind of respect to the counterexamples, seeming, the feeling that competent deduction is knowledge preserving, the egregious violations point, this thing about knowing it's a red barn without knowing it's a barn, the egregious non-violations point, the worry that heavy-duty consequences still get through, and finally the proof of closure from innocent-seeming assumptions that's there in the margin. Okay, so I'm gonna try to like get through all of these at some point. I'm going to start at the bottom, with the proof of closure from innocent-seeming assumptions. So look at those two principles, addition and distribution. Either of them suffices. I'm not questioning that. I want you to notice, though, a difference between them. They're about similarly basic transitions, dropping a conjunct, adding a disjunct. The dropping a conjunct one, sorry, the adding a disjunct one says, you know P or Q, on competently inferring it from P. So, by parity of reasoning, you might expect the other one to say, you know Q by or P by confidently inferring it from P and Q. But somehow, Hawthorne doesn't think it's necessary, and intuitively it's not necessary to mention. You know, you don't think, oh man, I just worked out that, you know, that Q, how did you figure, well, you know P and Q, right? And then, you know, that's not how it works. It sort of seems like you already have to know Q to know P and Q. And so you can distinguish like two different ways that closure might function. On the one hand, it could be that you have to know an implication before you count as knowing the implier. And the other one would be you can know the implication on the basis of the implier. And addition seems like it's under the second category, and distribution seems like it's under the first category. So there do seem to be two possibly importantly different forms of closure at issue, the ones I just mentioned. So let's call them the first one, imminent closure. You know something that's, so to speak, already there. And hope I pronounced this right, transient closure, where there's this thing that's sort of outside the premise that you kind of make your way to. And the obvious principle about imminent closure is, if you know a thing, then you know its parts. Because a conjunct is the paradigm part, ignoring sort of logical funny business where you treat something as a conjunction, but at some deeper level it might not be. And then, so that's imminent closure. And then another way to say it, given our definition of part in terms of subject matter inclusion, is that if you know something, then you know its implications, unless somebody switches up the subject matter on you and throws in some new subject matter. And indeed, if you look back at the examples, they do all seem to involve some new subject matter is brought in. Misleading counter evidence, or you know, painted mule, etc., etc. So is that a coincidence? Well, it doesn't really seem like it. It seems like the new subject matter is what makes Q more vulnerable than P. It seems like bringing the new stuff in, all of a sudden, P, well, as represented, so to speak, in Q, it has like newly exposed flanks. It's sort of newly vulnerable to things that might come after it. So that's intuitive. How does it work on the theory? Well, remember, Q is part of P. If Q's ways of being true are implied by P's ways of being true, and Q's ways of being false are implied by P's ways of being false. Let's focus on the second of those. I think the first could be relevant to knowledge as well. So the second of those says, Q's ways of being false are implied by P's. If you think about it, there's a little proof in the margin there. That's pretty much certain to mean, although maybe not. Keane had a good counterexample before, but it's very likely to mean that Q's ways of being false just are among P's ways of being false. Because suppose you have a way for Q to be false. By modus tollens, it implies the falsity of P. So therefore, anything you added to that way for Q to be false would be unnecessary from the point of view of establishing that P is false. And so you might think on the basis of some kind of commensuration or proportionality view that you shouldn't add that extra stuff in. You know, you already had something sufficient for the falsity of Q. Maybe I'm sort of illicitly going back and forth between ways of being false and reasons for being false there. That's quite possible. But I'm just going to sort of take it for granted. It seems intuitive anyway that if Q is part of P, then anything that makes Q false makes P false. Because it's sort of like just saying, if the tabletop is part of the table, and anything that makes the tabletop radioactive makes the table radioactive. There's no other way. You don't say, well, I want to add some more to what makes the table radioactive. I mean, you can, but you've already got enough in the tabletop being radioactive. Okay, so what you really have when Q is not a part of P is the possibility of you're going to have new ways for Q to be false that aren't among P's ways of being false, as you would have if Q was part of P. And then the thought is, look, you might well think that new ways of being false, that's going to be a threat to knowledge in any theory that associates knowledge with counter possibilities, because we've really got new counter possibilities. So the way to think of it is like, yes, consequences are weaker than what implies them, but, you know, as we know from like high school, weaker things sometimes pick more fights, right? And so you can just think of it in terms of, Q, like not a heavily painted mule, is sort of marching right up to the skeptical bully and saying and defying it, right? Even though it's a little bit weaker, nevertheless, it's kind of like calling out the attacker by name, and so that's bound to kind of arouse. Anyway, the metaphor has already gone too far. Okay. So what kind of theory links knowledge to counter possibilities? Well, any number of theories could, just bracketing our probable belief that there's no good theory of knowledge. There certainly are sort of considerations you could mention that seem like they're connected to knowledge. I'll just use the word theory. It could be a sensitivity theory. We would have noticed or had different evidence, had a counter-possibility obtained. If there's new counter-possibilities, then maybe we would have noticed the first, but we don't notice the new one. A safety-type theory could have this feature, too. Each of the counter-possibilities might be sort of dangerous, each in its own way, another way in which your belief might not be safe. Probabilistic theory, or an explanatory theory that sees each new counter-possibility as sort of a new possible explanation that would have to be sort of defeated of how it might be that you're believing that P despite its falsity. Generally, like all kinds of ways of thinking of knowledge, kind of see possible new trouble in new alternatives to the proposition supposedly known. So I'm going to go with the sensitivity approach despite the difficulties. I'm going to write bold PI with a line on the top, although I'll probably just like not mention the line. That's a counter possibility to P. Italic P is like is the sentence, you can think of it that way, or the statement. And all the counter possibilities in general are that P1, bold P2, bold P3, dot dot dot, bold PN. P is false if one of those counter possibilities obtain. That's what it is for P to be false, for one of those reasons for it to be false to obtain, or one of those ways of being false to obtain. So we get the following counterfactual. If we're going to be a sensitivity theorist, we're thinking, if it hadn't been that P, S would have noticed. Well, hadn't been that P, that's like, had P been false, that's like, had one of the false makers obtained, had one of those bold PIs obtained. So that's what I have there under Roman 1, had P1 obtained, or P2, or P3, S would have noticed. Now, suppose we give counterfactuals the so-called strong reading, which I'm not, like, at this point prepared to argue whether this is reasonable or not, and it's a very complicated issue. But the strong reading is one that says, if you've got a disjunctive antecedent to a counterfactual, then you can infer, in fact, maybe it's equivalent to, the conjunction of counterfactuals that takes each of those disjuncts as a separate antecedent. So had it been that A or B, it would have been that C, that's the same as, had it been that A, it would have been that C, and had it been that B, it would have been at C. So, you know, I'm just stipulating this for present purposes. It doesn't really matter if this is equivalent to what, say, Nozick would have said. You can think of it as a different theory. In fact, I think of it as a different theory. It's sort of like a kind of refined sensitivity theory that can look separately at all the different possible ways of being false and demand sensitivity to every single one of them. Well, suppose that you accept the strong reading of counterfactuals, and suppose that Q is a part of P. If Q is a part of P, then Q's falsity makers are some among the falsity makers for P. So let's just suppose they're the prime numbered ones. So Q's falsity makers are like P2, P3, P5, P7, and so on. So then we get, on the strong reading, Roman numeral 3 on the handout, had P2 obtained, S would have noticed. Had P3 obtained, S would have noticed. Had P5 obtained, S would have noticed. Well, is this true? Would S have noticed? We don't have to worry about that. We already have in the previous line that S would have noticed even a larger accumulation of these things. Okay. There's a little bit of fudging going on here with the phrase S would have noticed. You might ask, well, you might think, well, what belief is it actually that's sensitive? And so I'm definitely kind of fudging that. So if you look at, so 3 is basically just a subconjunction of 2. And so knowing that P suffices to this extent for knowing its part Q. And you don't have any such assurance with other consequences because you've got new sensitivity requirements. There have to be, like, had P new obtained, S would have noticed. Okay, so now let's come around to some of the other points that we wanted to kind of make sense of. One was egregious violations. So Kripke objects to Nozick, one can know it's a red barn without knowing it's a barn. And that goes against even imminent closure, right? Because being a barn is part of being a red barn, I assume. So what are we going to say? Something has to give. Well, the point to notice, and I think even Nozick could have said this, is that, it's a red barn has two different ways of failing. You don't have to just, like, focus on the easy way. You can consider them separately. It could fail through not being red or not being a barn. It seems not crazy to suppose that for, like, suppose it's a conjunctive, like red, suppose it's like an intersective adjective and this just means it's red and it's a barn. It's not crazy to suppose that you should have noticed if it had been false the first conjunct way and if it had been false the second conjunct way. But that makes the counterexample go away. And indeed, in general, I argued already that if B is part of A, then imminent closure is actually preserved by the sensitivity theory that we have, which is just a slight variant of Nozick's. And just dividing up the different counter possibilities. Okay. And then there's the second, there's the egregious non-violations point. So Dretzky wants his sensitivity type theory to deliver knowledge of lightweight truths, but not to deliver knowledge of heavyweight truths. And Hawthorne questions, in an exchange with Dretzky on closure, whether heavy-duty knowledge has in fact been blocked. Because, Dretzky says, I know it's a zebra. I don't know. It's not a disguised mule. But then Hawthorne points out, well, you do know it's a zebra and not a disguised mule. Just like, I know I'm hungry and not a brain in a vat. Okay? Because if it had failed to be a zebra and not a disguised mule, it would have taken the easier pickings, which was the first conjunct, right? Better, easier to make that false than the second conjunct. Okay? So it seems as though Dretzky is allowing heavyweight knowledge through, but again, we can say the same thing. Zebra and not disguised mule has, like, at least two ways of being false, one having to do with zebras, one having to do with being a disguised mule. You're sensitive to the first, maybe, but you're not sensitive to the second. And that's why you don't know the conjunction. So again, there's no violation of imminent closure in either of these cases. It seemed like there was. It seemed like you knew P and Q and not Q, because you let yourself off easy as far as, like, what it took to know that P and Q. You said, whatever is the easiest way for that to fail, I'm going to be sensitive to that. But really, you should just talk about all the salient ways for it to fail, including, the first conjunct and the second conjunct. Okay. Now let's go back to the thing about simpler principles from which you can prove that closure holds on the basis of simpler principles. So I've been representing imminent closure as kind of somehow safer than full closure, and certainly as weaker than full closure. But you might find this puzzling because imminent closure is kind of like a generalization of distribution. If you know a conjunction, then you know its conjuncts. And we just saw on the previous page that granted a certain assumption equivalence, that distribution is enough to get full closure back. And of course, I put equivalence up there as though it's completely, you know, obvious that it holds, and it's certainly, even when I think about it, it seems obvious. If you know P and it's a priori equivalent to Q, you better know Q as well. But let's push a little bit. How can I know Q but not Q prime if the two are a priori equivalent? Well, look, we talked about this in lecture one. Equivalents do not necessarily agree in what they're about. They can sort of strike us quite differently. So the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. Those are on the sort of unreasonable, perhaps, definitions that I was proposing of, like, the rich and the poor. Those are equivalent. Intelligent women tend to marry, highly intelligent women tend to marry less intelligent men. That's equivalent to men and women who get married are not exactly equal in intelligence, according to, given the phenomenon of regression to the mean. If they vary at all, then the outliers on the, you know, intelligence side are going to, on the whole, marry things that are closer to the mean. So that's how it seems to be with, you know, that's a zebra, and that's a zebra and not a cleverly disguised mule. If a zebra is about, let's just say, to give it an official, bold-faced, you know, subject matter, it's about whether it's a zebra or a horse or a mule or some fourth thing, okay? Whereas, and that, I should have said it's a zebra and not a mule, that I left something out there, is about whether it's a zebra or a horse or a regular mule or a cleverly painted mule or some fifth thing. Well, I certainly know that it's a zebra as regards the first of these, but the second subject matter, by subdividing the mule worlds, asks more of me. It calls for greater powers of discernment. I have to be sensitive to, there have to be more worlds in which I would notice because I've subdivided the terrain. It's not a Lewis type picture in which certain worlds are just being ignored and considered beyond the pale. The same worlds are in play either way. It's just that by carving them up differently, and treating the counterfactuals the way we did, you're just required to, like, satisfy one more counterfactual, and that one could be the one that causes all the trouble. Okay, so the mulish region of logical space presents one challenge to the would-be that's a zebra knower, but it presents two to the would-be knower of that's a zebra and not a disguised mule. Okay, now I'm going to bring back a chart from earlier, although I kind of changed some things a little bit. So the chart was supposed to show, you know, cases where S is intentionally equivalent to S star. And, you know, probably you can treat them as a priori equivalent in most cases. But they still seem to possibly differ in truth conditional contribution. They seem to sort of play a different role when they're embedded in certain contexts. Of course, all this is controversial, you might think. I think pretty much everyone agrees that in some contexts these genuinely do change truth values. They might not agree with the particular ones that I'm giving. So, one of the ones that I, as I said, regular propositions, they're sensitive to whether the statement is true or false. But directed propositions, enhanced propositions, sort of fitted out with subject matters, are sensitive not only to that, but to how the hypothesis is true or false. And so the question would be, do hyper-intentional context, which is the name for contexts that care about more than the intention, the set of worlds, say, do they care about the how? Well, from what I just said, counterfactuals on the strong reading do care about the how, because if you change the hypothesis to bring out that there's these different ways that it can be false, then you're suddenly required on the strong reading to have more conjuncts to your explication of the original counterfactual. So if I say, you know, so I don't know if this example quite works, but you know, suppose I say, do I know it's a charged particle? Well, if it hadn't been charged, I would have noticed. Do I know it's a negatively or positively charged particle? Well, that requires more. Has to be, if it wasn't negatively charged, I would have noticed. And if it wasn't positively charged, I would have noticed. I might give a better example in a minute. I can't remember if I left it in. Okay, so here's some examples. All crows are black. None black things are not crows. Famously, Hempel thinks that these kind of differ conformationally. The whole fourth lecture that I'm not doing was all about that, or things of that in that vicinity. The example that I gave last time was, here's the context. Rudy is an example of how all crows are black. Rudy's a witness, if you like, to the truth of all crows are black, assuming it's true. He's not a witness to the fact, which may be a fact, that non-black things are not crows. Well, how will that... So I'm going to try to sort of do what I can to sort of force some of these into a counterfactual format. It's not... They're not like literally good analyses, but just that you'll see that it's in the same ballpark, and that might make you wonder whether the hyperintentionality exhibited by the counterfactual would also apply to the original context, which wasn't explicitly counterfactual. So here's my counterfactual. For Rudy is an example of how all crows are black. All crows are black cannot, given the example of Rudy, be wholly false. Rudy prevents all crows are black from being wholly false. Rudy does not prevent all non-black things are non-crows from being wholly false, because everything in the universe could be a crow. If everything in the universe was a crow, then non-black things are not crows would be wholly false. But all crows are black would not be wholly false, because it would have this one instance, Rudy. So that's an objective difference between Rudy's relation to all crows are black and all non-black things are non-crows. I gave this example. All truths are known. Imagine like some scientist, you know, really wants that to be the case. So Jane hopes for the day when all truths are known. She doesn't hope for the day that nothing unknown is true, because to hope for that, I mean, to realize that ambition, you could take some things that you don't know and falsify them by like destroying the microparticles that would be a counterexample, or you know, just making the world simpler in some way. Maybe there's one person who's like the only counterexample to your, you know, to all truths are known. You kill them, and now now you've got nothing unknown is true. Well, what's the counterfactual in the neighborhood? Well, Jane will be happier if all truths are known than otherwise. But it's not clear that she'll be happier if nothing unknown is true than otherwise, because nothing unknown is true suggests a different kind of possibility, which is not going to sort of gratify Jane's sort of, you know, scientific urges there. Okay. She appreciates that she is lost versus she's right to think that she is lost. And I said, fortunately, she appreciates she is lost. That's true. Fortunately, she's right to think she is lost. That sounds bad, because that means she already thought she was lost. And now, it was, you know, it would have been better if she was wrong about that. But in fact, we're saying she really is lost. That seems bad. Well, here's the counterfactual in the neighborhood. It would be worse for her if she didn't appreciate that she was lost. That seems right. It would be worse for her if she wasn't right to think she was lost. That seems wrong. Okay? The different, you know, the fronting and backgrounding of different kinds of information in a hypothesis plays into the way it embeds counterfactually, because you tend not to want to sort of cancel or vary the backgrounded information, just the foregrounded information. And there's a bunch more examples of this kind, like, you know, you don't have pneumonia. That's equivalent to you don't have bacterial or viral pneumonia. Let's just suppose this is like background information we all have. Well, it could be that bacterial pneumonia is very rare. So you go to the doctor, they just test you for viral pneumonia. The test says you don't have it. So the evidence really does suggest that you don't have pneumonia, because that's what you would have if you had pneumonia, the viral kind. But the evidence does not obviously suggest that you don't have bacterial or viral pneumonia, because it doesn't even bear on whether you have bacterial pneumonia. And again, there's a related counterfactual. You say, otherwise, the test would be negative. If you had pneumonia, the test would be negative. But if you had bacterial or viral pneumonia, you can't assume the test would be negative, because you could have bacterial, and the test isn't sensitive to that, etc. And then there was the one about, you know, the Garden of Eden. You're told by the deity, go ahead, you know, eat infinitely many apples. That's fine. That's one possible thing that God could have said. Another thing God could have said is, we're sitting here, only finitely many apples on the tree of knowledge. God could have said, go ahead, have infinitely many apples not on the tree of knowledge. Okay? So maybe the serpent like tells you that. Maybe the serpent comes along. God says the second thing. Have infinitely many apples not on the tree of knowledge. And the serpent comes along and points out to you that that is necessarily equivalent to have infinitely many apples. Right? Because if there's only finitely many apples on the tree of knowledge, and we could write it into the sentence if we wanted, then you have infinitely many apples, if and only if you have infinitely many apples not in the tree of knowledge, because the finite number of apples in the tree of knowledge can't make a difference to whether you have infinitely many apples. So the serpent says, look, what God told you is look, totally equivalent to you just have infinitely many apples. Okay? But of course, it's a very different kind of permission, and that is brought out if you just think of the counterfactual. Nothing bad will happen if you have infinitely many apples not on the tree of knowledge. True. Nothing bad will happen if you have infinitely many apples. False, because you might have some from the tree of knowledge, even though those are necessarily equivalent. Okay, so I want to say these are not a million miles from epistemology, these examples. I can't know, I didn't actually give this example, so I say, Al testified that, say, Claire stole the diamonds versus testified that Claire stole the diamonds. Okay, these are kind of different things. What counts as Al perjuring himself might vary depending on what he said. If he testified that Claire stole the diamonds, and then it turned out it was Daphne, he's in trouble. But if it turned out it wasn't diamonds, he's probably not in trouble, because you know the question from the attorney could well have been who stole the diamonds or something of that nature. Okay. So this connects with epistemology, because like testimony is kind of relevant to knowledge. I can't know that it was diamonds if all I have to go on is Al's testimony, and what he said was Claire stole the diamonds, but he didn't say Claire stole the diamonds. Rudy is not as supportive of this contrapositive, all non-black things are non-crows, because it might be wholly false where he's concerned, whereas the other can't be wholly false where he's concerned. Why that should make it less supportive, I don't really know, but I just said that. I don't know it's a real Rolex if all I have to go on is how it looks from here, because how it looks from here is the same whether it's a real Rolex or an unreal Rolex. Etc. And there's here's an example from epistemology class. So you teach. By the way, I'll just tell you right now, so you don't feel bad when you find this example unintuitive. But a lot of people don't find it intuitive. But here goes. So in epistemology class, you know, you tell your students, look, you might be dreaming, and they say, wow, you know, this is like completely lifelike experience. But you're right, I couldn't tell if I was dreaming. And so they're prepared to accept on that basis. Let's say maybe they're wrong too, but see, they say, I don't know that experiences this lifelike are not dreams. Experiences this lifelike might be dreams. So they don't know this generalization. All experiences this lifelike are not dreams. But they'll often then go on to say, you know, that's really interesting, because as a matter of fact, my actual dreams are not this lifelike. Right? So they think they, some of them think they actually know that. But what do they know? They know, all my dreams are not this lifelike. So, say that, say it's like, that's like all D are N. No D are, whatever, put it this way. Those two are equivalent. One is saying no Fs or Gs, one is saying no Gs or Fs. No dreams of mine are this lifelike is equivalent to nothing this lifelike is a dream of mine. But they don't think they know the second one, and they think they know the first, I say. Okay. And then you could give other sorts of examples as well. I shouldn't advise you to eat poison or dirt or etc. If I don't know that it would be better for you, I might know that it's better for you to eat than not to eat without knowing it's better for you to eat poison or dirt or sausages or da-da-da. Okay? And that, you know, generally you shouldn't advise people to do stuff that, for all you know, might be bad for them. Okay. So, I want to say that knowledge contexts don't look too out of place in this kind of chart. I'm not saying the case is as good, but it's not a crazy idea either. And there's a bunch of examples down there of how it might be that you know, here's equivalent things. You know one and perhaps not the other. I know I locked the door. I don't know I locked, and contrary evidence is misleading. If you think of the corresponding counterfactual, it predicts that you don't. Maybe I read a report and I check each sentence against the facts and they all seem right. So say, this report is true. I know that. Now somebody says, okay, but do you know it's true and self-consistent? Well, I might well think, I don't know, I didn't actually check to see if everything was consistent with everything else. I just checked individually to make sure everything was true. It seems like it introduces a new consideration, potentially, etc. Okay, now two big problems. So I don't expect people to actually buy what I just said. I'm treating it as a semantic phenomenon that you might have variation in whether you know things just through hyper-intentional differences between the propositions in question. Maybe it's not semantic, maybe it's pragmatic. You might still want to use some of the same machinery to sort of explain the pragmatic variation in judgments. But even if you buy all what I just said, there's still two enormous problems. First is, deduction is supposed to be knowledge-preserving in general, not only with parts. It's not as though when people sort of like give a logical argument, they say, okay, here I go. You know, you accept this, you accept that, blah, blah, blah. Here's the conclusion. It's not as though they say, oh, wait, let me first check that it's not a mere consequence. It's actually a part. Obviously, since I just made the notion of part up like 4 weeks ago, this is not part of epistemic practice to check if something is a part. But I've only given a version of closure that says that knowledge is preserved under the deduction of parts. The second difficulty, which I'm not sure we'll get to, is that prima facie closure violations are not limited to mere consequences, as it seems like I've suggested. So you might think, going back to the Frege example, that the number of Martian moons is prime includes the number of Martian moons exist. It's not a new subject matter, you might think. The example that Alan Baker gave me that I think is kind of clever. Apparently, like the front sprocket and the chain wheel of a bike, the ratio of the number of teeth is generally, they're generally co-prime, because that sort of prevents sort of wear and tear. There's not like constructive, so to speak, interference wearing down some, you know. So that, he gave that to me as an example of a mathematical explanation, right? Why are like bikes made this way? Well, because this number and this number are co-prime. Anyway, you might well think that the number of sprocket teeth is always co-prime with the number of chain wheel teeth, but that includes that some numbers are co-prime, right? But that looks like it might be more problematic to know than the thing about the sprocket teeth. So here's a wild conjecture that the main thing to be said for it is that it gives a line on these sorts of examples. The conjecture is, try as we might to deduce a mere consequence, we wind up deducing a part. Is that to say that I'm not a brain in a vat as part of I am standing? Well, it could be part. Because what a hypothesis includes depends on its subject matter. And its subject matter depends on the discourse context. So therefore, its parts depend on the discourse context. Suggestion might be that context extends not just to the stuff that happened before the person spoke, but also the uses to which it's put later. So you might well say that P's subject matter is sensitive to what is done with P. It's sort of retroactively changed, if you like, by the fact that you deduced Q from it. And intuitively, it doesn't seem all that crazy. I have this sort of nice, ordinary piece of knowledge. I deduce this sort of anti-skeptical thing. And I just want to look back and say, oh, I guess if I'm going to actually stick with that deduction, I better treat the commitment to the first thing as sort of more serious than I'd initially imagined. So the idea is, when you deduce Q from P, P subject matter expands to include that of Q. The conclusion's vulnerabilities are taken on by the premise, and which may lead to a reconsideration of that premise. So like, I am standing starts out addressing itself to my posture, which you can take to be like whether I'm standing or sitting or doing a handstand or, you know, a few other things. Or other. Okay. So it's false if I'm sitting, etc. The brain and the vat worlds are mixed in with the others. They're not separately treated. So when I conclude that I'm not a brain and a vat, all of a sudden I'm standing. We go into the other worlds and we pull out as a separate category the ones where I'm not standing because I'm a brain in a vat and don't have a body with which to stand. So an example, this is kind of an analogy that I kind of like. So imagine that someone like, you're going on one of those like tourist buses through kind of Bel Air, and they're showing where the stars live and all that, you know, and Wayne Newton lives there and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden there's like an issue about property rights comes up, and they're like, who owns the oil on a certain property? And you show up and you say, look, you know, my movie star map says that the property line is here. Well, there's something funny going on there, and it's not easy to say exactly what it is. It's not that the map is like lying exactly. It's just that it considers itself answerable to only like certain kinds of problems, like Wayne Newton moved out, not to like the exactly where the property line is. So I say the map is not wrong, it's just surprised to find itself directed at that subject matter. It wasn't prepared for that, you know. And likewise, I want to say, you know, I am standing is not wrong, it's just surprised to find itself directed at a skeptical subject matter. And that makes for a change in its own subject matter, because it now has to be attentive to the possibilities that it wasn't initially. So, say big P, or I'll call that script P, I'll usually just say P, but say script P is the proposition ordinarily expressed by the sentence P. And by proposition, I here mean directed proposition enhanced with subject matter. And suppose P plus is the variant with the puffed up subject matter that P acquires in order to contain as a part the Q that was deduced from it. So we know that P plus is true or false in the very same worlds as P, but it's not true or false in the very same ways. So these new contour lines are drawn, and they allow P plus to contain Q where P did not contain Q. So here's the question. We knew that P, do we also know that P plus? And I want to say it could go either way. So here's yes. We do know what P comes to say, namely P plus, in addition to what it said initially. So a scenario where that happens is, take I have hands, I deduce I have hands or claws. Okay, so now I say what that does is it separates out the worlds where I don't have hands, it separates out the ones where I have neither hands nor claws. Maybe the next most likely thing for me to have besides hands or claws, these are all Jonathan Sheffer's examples, is tentacles. Okay, so I now have to be sensitive to whether I have tentacles. But that's cool, I am sensitive to whether I have tentacles. So this is a case that even after you like blow up the subject matter of I have hands, so it requires sensitivity to whether I have tentacles, no problem, I'm good on tentacles too, right? So I keep on knowing the conclusion that I got from that premise because I keep on knowing the premise. But there's other kind of cases where once you kind of build up the subject matter of the premise, all of a sudden that makes it harder to know. And so an example of that would be, again, Q is part of P plus, but we don't know P plus. So I infer I'm not a brain in a vat from the premise that I'm standing grows to address a subject matter, say, posture plus, that's cognizant of the line between brain in a vat and non-brain in a vat world. So to know what it now says, to know what I am standing now says, I have to be defended somehow against the brain in a vat scenario. So otherwise I can't be said any longer to know that I am standing. So this is kind of like the usual kind of contextualist two-step, right? You know, you have this ordinary knowledge, you deduce something anti-skeptical, and then some weird thing happens where you go and you revisit the premise that you deduced it from, and you say, oh, maybe I don't know it after all. This is just a different story about what happens. It's not that the standards for knowing change, it's not that the, you know, any of the normal things that are said change. What's changed, actually, is the proposition that's a candidate for being known. And that'll come up, that'll be important just right now. So take this, I just said I can't be said any longer to know that I'm standing. You might think that this, you know, concedes too much to the skeptic. Because even in a skeptical context, you might think, okay, I don't know that I'm standing, but still, I'm in a better epistemic position with respect to that than I am with respect to, like, I'm not a brain in a vat. You sort of kind of feel like you've got some grip on the standing issue, even if not enough of a grip to defeat the skeptic, which you don't sort of feel with the brain in a vat thing. So I call that the something left feeling. You feel something is left even after you've lost your knowledge that you're standing. You still feel you've got some kind of, you know, bruised dignity. And you sort of want to stand up and say, but wait, and then, but you're not sure quite what to say. So that's what I want to look at now. So I call it the something left feeling. So Nozick explains this something left feeling just too well, because he says, look, you know P, you don't know Q. You don't have to apologize. You still know P, just the same as before. Okay. But then my position is undiminished, which seems wrong. My position is diminished when I deduce this anti-skeptical consequence and then revisit the premise. The standard contextualist kind of doesn't explain it at all, because I know both P and Q according to the lower standards, and I know neither according to the higher standards. Okay? And so on the face of it, there's no explanation at all. So I want to suggest a third kind of Carnapian possibility. So I want to say the something left feeling is awareness at some level of undefeated internal knowledge. So the old proposition has been lying in wait for us the whole time. We've just been, as a potential object of knowledge, we've just been distracted from it by all this like skeptical hijinks. So I may not know what I am standing comes to express when its subject matter expands under skeptical pressure, but so what? The skeptic offered to deprive me of knowledge that I supposedly already had. I didn't supposedly already know this sort of souped up thing with the extra subject matter. I just thought I knew the ordinary proposition that I'm standing. The skeptic totally fails at depriving me of the knowledge I supposedly had, because I continue to know the proposition that I am standing used to express. It's just that I now have to characterize it as the part of I am standing about my posture. That one I still know. I'm still sensitive to all the counter possibilities that are contemplated in that subject matter. So I want to say, lightweight propositions retain, even in skeptical contexts, a substantial known part. And you might ask, well, shouldn't we extend the same courtesy to their heavyweight consequences? And imminent closure suggests that I should also know the part of I'm not a brain in a vat about my posture. So this gives the skeptic an opening. Don't I now have to know the part of I'm not a brain in a vat that concerns my posture, and maybe that'll be problematic, and then it'll make trouble for my knowledge that I'm standing. But no, if you think about it, the part of, well, it takes more than just thinking about it. I gave an argument on the margin there. If you work it out, the part of I am not a brain in a vat that concerns my posture is trivial. There's nothing really to know there. You've just sort of lost anything of interest. It's true in every world, I would say, just about the part of I am not a brain in a vat that concerns my posture. So I'll just say this last thing and then I'll stop. I won't go into the second kind of examples. So I want to say the seeming closure violations that we began with, they are genuine in one sense. So one can know P without knowing its mere consequence Q. So there's a possibility there, but the window of possibility closes when you attempt to deduce Q from P. Now we either stop knowing that P or we know it together with Q. So there is something elusive here. That's the title of Lewis's paper on contextualism about knowledge, elusive knowledge. But it's not knowledge. Knowledge is always the same relation. We keep on knowing the exact same propositions that we did before. All that's lost is the possibility of expressing the proposition that we still know with the once suitable sentence. So that's really a phenomenon of elusive expressibility with a particular that clause. But that is not a surprise. We're very familiar with elusive expressibility with a particular that clause. Yeah. So I'll stop.